It's okay to drink coffee, isn't it?
Of course it's okay to drink coffee. Okay. Well, welcome everybody to the first Sportscar Safari podcast. You're here with myself, Andrew Cold, Luke Jackser on the other camera.
Hey, how you going?
Everyone. So yeah, welcome to our podcast. Obviously this is a bit of a new thing. I'm talking to you from Cambridge in the United Kingdom. We're currently under full lockdown due to coronavirus. Luke is in sunny South Australia in Adelaide, yep. Which isn't in lockdown, probably should be.
Nope. should have been 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Anyway, here we are. So yeah, look, this the podcast is something we've been talking about for a while to do, because obviously print magazines are great and it's sort of where we have started and what we enjoy doing, but there's still, you know, nothing beats actually talking to the people, and there's just so many interesting stories out there, and we've been talking about this idea for a long time, and figured that since we're all housebound at the moment, it's a really good time to actually do it. So here we are. Thanks for coming along for the ride. So,
and yeah, like it was a bit of a last minute thing. Andrew and I, we only came up with the idea to do it Monday or Tuesday night or something.
Yeah.
Like it was really last minute. So apologies if things are not 100%. We fit around with a few little bits here and there while we find our feet. It's new to both of us, same way that magazine was new to both of us. We had never done that before. So really excited to have you guys along for the ride and seeing how we go. And Andrew, introduce who we have with us tonight, this morning, wherever you are in the world.
Us tonight, this morning. just to clarify, I guess it's Thursday evening, Luke, Thursday morning for myself. And
Thursday
we are
evening.
Joined by Xander Pickering of Boyzone Garage.
Hey, everyone.
Welcome to the first podcast, Xander.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Luke. Good to be here.
Awesome.
So I apologize to Xander for sticking him in the corner of my shed.
That's okay.
As we tried to quickly figure out what a studio was, my office in the shed was far too small to abide by the 1.5-meter distance that we have in Australia for no more than two people in one indoor room that's not family at the moment. So
but Xander,
we were stuck in the shed.
That's right.
So I guess, Xander, we should have a chat. Like, Boyzone Garage, what is it? How did you start? What do you do? Who are you?
Great question. So Boyzone Garage came to me one day. I think I was sitting at home, probably a Friday night or a Sunday night, and I'm like, it'd be really cool to have a thing that brought like-minded people together. Like, it was never set up to be a business or a brand. I guess it was just like an idea. I remember back in 1998 going to the original Dutton's Garage in Melbourne, which was basically just a fantastic toy shop. You know, it was someone's hobby with these fantastic cars. I remember seeing my first ever Carrera RS in there and all these cabinets full of toys and models, and it just appealed to me. So I was like, I'd love to have something like that. Clearly not in a position to have that, but I know all these like-minded people, and I thought, hey, let's just start small. Let's start with a Facebook page, an Instagram account, put cars on there that
I
like.
Boyzone Garage.
At Boyzone Garage.
Follow on the channels. Yeah.
You know, put stuff on there that I like. Keep up in touch with friends. Just do stuff with friends, and it hasn't grown much bigger than that. You know, got some t-shirts, got some stickers and patches. Hit us up if you'd like some. But it was a way of having an outlet of showing people what I liked in cars and, you know, all sorts of other things as well, but mostly vehicles and motorsport related.
Don't promote the stickers too much.
Yeah. Xander, then you'll have to make
them. Yeah. I have to make them. Xander bought a vinyl cutter and promptly said, I got no room for this in my house. I'm renovating at the moment. You've got room in your shed. Put it in there. And by the way, while you're at it, do you want to make me some stickers?
Yeah, and P.S. my files are already on there. But no, it's good. And, you know, Adelaide's such a small place that the idea of Boyzone Garage, if it could take off and be something big, is people could just hang there, you know, like we are now in Luke's shed that's far bigger than mine.
Studio, you mean?
Yeah, studio.
Studio.
It's the sort of thing that, you know, like, if I won the $80 million lotto tonight, which I won't because I haven't got a ticket, but I'd go and buy a cool old building, set it up, get car clubs to have their meetings there, have some cool cars there. Let's do that father-son thing that I guess got me into cars.
So, you know, the power of that, which I found fascinating, is, Xander, a few years ago, when I'm going to absolutely bastardize the pronunciation of the lovely man's surname, but our friend Andre Bezudenoit, calling through Adelaide on his world tour. For those that don't know, Andre's profile is somewhat higher now than it was when we met him, but he's been featured on Petrolicious and a bunch of websites, but he, races an idle historic Formula One car, but we met him when he was doing his world tour in a 1972 911. And I remember Xander dropped me a message. It was like a Sunday morning, and said, "Hey, I've just dropped this Andre guy an Instagram message through Boyzone Garage. And, you know, if he turns up, do you want to come and say hi?" And sure, you know, and he was, from memory, about 3 hours later, because he got caught at Old Tatum Town, which is a whole another story for those who don't know. I guess the point of this was that we were talking to him in Kolandi for, you know, an hour, and he chucks us the keys to the 911, and we're off sort of tearing around through the Adelaide Hills in this incredible South African registered 911. And all of that was really just through Instagram, really. Yep. There's nothing else. And I guess I see what you mean about that community there. It's very cool. So
speaking of community, I mean, I was, you know, I think we've all been lucky enough to drive Andre's car that I got to drive it during Adelaide Rally and do the Prima Tour in it, which was fantastic, and you know, had a little bit of squirt up near Kamantoo there, which was great, and have a run around the bend as well, which is awesome. Pop out the fuel.
But I mean, like, you touched on something really good there. Like, I think that was, what, the first or second 911 you'd ever driven, Andrew, wasn't it?
Second one. So first time I'd driven one properly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you've driven that. Luke's driven it around the bend. I was fortunate enough, again, through social media, a gentleman called Lars Muller was doing a tour in Australia in his 356. And managed to put together a private session at the bend through some Porsche people I knew. And the next minute, a car you guys have featured in SCS, GK's, first right-hand drive, 911 or 901.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, I'm like, "Oh, I'd love to go around the track in it." And he's like, "Yeah, sure." And throws me the keys. I'm like, "What do you mean? Like, you want me to take it?" He's like, "Yeah, go for it." So, you know, I'm doing two laps of this thing, a little bit tail happy around the bend. And it's just, yeah.
I think Stu's car. So for those who don't know, Stuart Kay in Adelaide has, it was in the first issue of Sports Car Safari, we featured it, but it's a very important early short wheelbase 901. So before the 911 became the 911, it's the 901. And it's the first right-hand drive, or the first 911 delivered to Australia. It's what, Xander, the third right-hand drive 911 built? Second.
I think it's something like that. Yeah,
second or third.
First five.
It's very early. And this car is completely original. It's the paint, I think, has been touched up in a few places, but it has never been repainted. The interior trim is original. The engine, matching numbers, everything, the keys down to the numbers, like anything you can think of. And he has the full suite of sales literature, of history, of invoices, it is the complete picture of any Porsche collector around the world would give their left nut to have this car, and it would be worth six figures easy, probably.
It's funny you should say that. I remember
seven-figure car, nearly a seven-figure car.
Probably. I remember talking to him 2015 Adelaide Rally, just before they the bubble got huge, and I said to him, you know, what would it have to be worth these days? It's like, you know, I'd only really swap it for a Carrera RS, and people are sort of thinking, "Oh, it's a $200,000-$300,000 car," and you know, have to up the insurance accordingly.
So, I'd be surprised if that's not in the UK, from what I've seen at dealerships. You know, like Sports Purpose and some of the guys, that'd have to be pushing seven figures, I think, these days. But anyway, so when we did the story of that car, I remember he lives in the hills near Stirling, and we've bumped up, and we've pulled onto the freeway at Stirling, and heading towards Bridgewater for those in Adelaide, but for those internationally, it's just a motorway opens up, and we hit the red line in about the first three or four gears, and not mucking around, like proper foot to the boards, 7,000 RPM rev limiter up through, and I can't say what speed we're doing, but in a 1966 901, it felt bloody fast. And and he just drives it as a car. He picks the kids up from school in it. He drives it in all weather. He takes it to, you know, let Sander drive it on the track. It's just amazing. And I think the Porsche community has a great bunch of people that actually use their cars, which I think is fascinating. And I guess that is a not so subtle segue into Sander, your Porsche. Tell us
my little project. So I guess I've always been a car guy, never always a Porsche guy. I always had an interest in them. And probably as I started to get a little bit older, I got serious about trying to track one down and spent some time in the Middle East in 2010 for work and was keeping an eye on the prices and saw some good cars at reasonable prices, prices where if we had a DeLorean, we'd go back and buy half a dozen of them. You know, I was looking at Australian delivered matching numbers cars, mid-year cars, so nothing startling, but starting to gain popularity now for low to mid-20s.
Yeah. Andrew, how many times have you wanted to go back in time and buy one of those? I know, I have plenty.
Don't even start.
So, and Mäkinens.
Isn't sort of had the option to buy one, didn't work out for a few reasons. A couple of months later, this American car pops up, Irish green, 66, 2 liter, left-hand drive, needed some work. It was about 10 grand US plus shipping. Exchange rate was good at the time. So again, would have been another car at or under 20. Again, didn't happen. A few things happened in my life and I was looking at car sales as I often do on lunch break. And there's this 66 short wheelbase up the road from my parents' place up in Houghton. And I'm like, ooh, that's pretty cool. Apparently it needs a gearbox, paint, and a window. I'm like, tempting. Anyway, discussed it with someone at the time. Wasn't going to happen. Something happened. It became available. Went and had a look at it with a friend of mine. And you know how they always say, never buy something on the spot? Well, yeah. So you know, this car was great. And we hopped in my mate's car. We drove him down the hill. And he says, what are you going to do, Xander? And I said, look, he wants 23 grand for this car. I'm thinking he's a little bit high. It's local. He's like, what are you going to do? I'm like, 15 grand. Going to offer him 15 grand and see what happens. He's like, you got 15 grand? I'm like, well, no, not on me. Like, he has 15 grand on him. And he's like, well, actually I do, because the business he ran, he had a float available. And he's like, let's go get the float. Give him a call, tell him we're coming back. So we go get the float, walk in, and I'm like, cool, man. I want to buy the car, but we got to talk about the price. He's like, okay, sure. He's like, what are you prepared to pay? So I've just grabbed 15 grand and just boom, dropped it on the table in front of him. And he's like, well, I'll give you one thing. You're serious, which is good. He's like, it's un-Australian not to negotiate on the price. I get that. So 22 and a half and it's yours. Yeah, clearly that didn't work, but signed up, 22 and a half grand, bought myself this car. Now, note at this time, I don't actually have anywhere to live. I've just basically been kicked out of where I've been living for the last 2 years and I've got nowhere to live. So fast forward, get a house, primarily with two garages in it so I could put the Porsche in there, get it home. Actually, I didn't even come home. It went to my friend's house. We stripped off the bumpers and a few other bits and pieces and it went straight to the panel shop. So it got painted within about 4 weeks of owning it.
Can I just interrupt you there? I still remember at the time just thinking, I couldn't work out if you were mad for spending that much money on what was essentially a raw shell and a pile of parts. But also I remember at the time thinking like, maybe Xander, I was like, he might have just made the smartest move in the world. I was like, it's 9/11. I was like, 10 grand on a paint job, bolt it all back together. He'll be driving in 6 months and he's got himself an air-cooled 9/11 for like, geez. I was like,
I think we've got the same story. That's what I've been hoping with Ruth. I told Ruth that buying old rusty Fiat 124 coupe shells was a good idea. You know, that'll be worth money someday. I don't think it's much.
I did it once with a Myers Monks dune buggy that
I remember that off you. And it was another one of those shoulda keep cars.
But I was like, it's complete. I was like, I'll spend a few weeks. I'll bolt back together. We'll drive it. Then we'll flip it. It'll be a great deal. Wrong. Anyway, carry on.
But yeah, you're 100% right. You can tell we're friends because I thought the same thing. I'll paint this thing. I'll buy a gearbox. I'll put a windscreen in it. Bolt it back together. It'll be good.
Did you really believe that though? Like going in and buying that car, or were you just selling it to yourself? Because I find I do that all the time too. That like I'll sit there and I'll be like, hey. Tell myself that this is going to be an easy task, or like I'll get this through this quickly and sell it to myself, and then realize later that I'm in trouble.
So, I think there's two ways to answer that question. There was definitely the I needed something in my life at that time, so it was going to happen regardless. But then there was a part of me where the person I bought it off was fairly honest, and he's like, look, there's a lot of good stuff here. Like he had receipts that were probably two or three times the value of what I paid for the car. So and there was boxes of stuff everywhere. So I'm like, maybe this is just a big Meccano set. So noting that our last car I built was a Fiat 500. So
this Porsche, just for those that don't know, was I guess quite a divisive car because it was a 912.
Yeah, let's be honest, it's a 912.
It is a 912 that's been converted to a 2.76 and a left hook to right hook. Yeah, which
Do
I
you
guess
have any photos on Facebook.
Yeah, there's photos on Facebook.
I'll bring them up and then we can show people.
So I guess at the time, and this raises a really interesting point that we want to delve into further with, you know, some further stories. But it's like, so as a collector's standpoint, like you compare it to, say, Stuart Kay's car we talked about earlier, nobody wants it. It's, you know, but actually it's a really good car, and the way that it had been converted, it had been done very professionally by someone who really knew what they were doing. It was probably a better thing than, I mean, am I saying equal to what had left the factory, or had it been improved?
So for those who are Porsche people, everyone understands the concept of sports purpose. So this is very much a sports purpose car, and I guess there's two sorts of cars that I'd always love to own. There'll be the ones that would be something you'd trailer to an event as a concours car. And to me, that's something that you build for other people to enjoy, something that's going to last, you know, outlast your life. And that's a different enjoyment, but I wanted something I could get in, drive and enjoy and give it a bit of a hard time. So yeah, I didn't want a matching numbers. Didn't care if the car was converted because I knew I was going to get purists saying, well, that's the wrong sticker for that year. I wanted something where I'm like, yep, you can tell this car isn't what it's supposed to be, but it's probably worth more than the sum of its parts. I don't mean financially. I mean in terms of the driving experience. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when was the last time you saw a half-caged, short wheelbase with a decent motor in it that's not a 2-litre, half-a-million-pound car?
Exactly. And so I guess we've, you know, fast-forward. I know that you've a lot of people that'll be watching this, but also I just think the fact that you never gave up on that project, that this is what, 10 years ago, and you got married, had kids, bought a second house, renovated said house, basically went through all of these phases. And I could see that it must have been damn tempting to sell that car. And especially when people at the time, I mean, you rode the air-cooled wave, because when you purchased this, it was sort of just before it kind of kicked off, and you had it through the peak, and now we're obviously softening a little bit. But you had people thrusting cash at you, which must have been hard to turn down when you were sort of struggling with everything else happening too. Like what was that like?
Exactly. Like there was times where I wanted to have something to enjoy, and when someone's like, hey, I'll give you x amount for it, and at some points I would have been, you know, at least breaking even, maybe making a profit, it was very tempting to do. But I didn't want to not finish it. I didn't want that failure of having people go, ha, you didn't finish it. I knew it wouldn't happen. It was too big a project. But yeah, you know, it was almost 7.5 years. So, you know, I went from being virtually homeless. So I went to one house. I then, you know, met my now wife, Emma. Moved into her house.
And almost ended up at my house at one point.
Yeah, almost ended up at Luke's house at one point. You know. And then we bought a house together, you know, had one kid. I spent 3 months living in the States, which we should probably touch on later and talk about the Porsche community there. It was just crazy. There was times when I'd be like, oh, I've really got to do something on the car, and Facebook would go, here's a memory from a year ago. And I'm like, oh, that was the last time I worked on the car.
Those Facebook memories get me every time. Yeah. It's like last time you touched something, and it was 4 years ago.
And there'd be times where it was like, you know, the bank account was flush, but I didn't have the time, even if I bought parts to bolt them on, or I had time and didn't have the money, and trying to get the two things together at the one time. Mm. Again, you know, it was really lucky that towards the end of the project, one of our good friends, Bryce, is in that position of having a massive shed with a massive hoist and a massive set of tools and nothing in it at the time. So in went the car, and I battled through two months of glandular fever whilst working on the car, which I didn't know until after that.
And then, so Luke, have you got some pictures we can share of the car? But the finished product, and this is what I like.
I'm trying to get some early pictures, but there's a long way to scroll through Facebook, so I might have to abandon.
There's a folder. It's got its own folder.
What's it called?
If you go to my albums, it should be like Project Penelope or something like that.
I'm trying to look for that, but I'm. Oh yeah,
there you go.
Maybe it's the top one. like I said, working out the bugs. what ones do you want to show? You show some of the ones in paint?
Start with the start if you want, so people see where it came from.
All right, great. Yeah, let's do that. All right, hang on.
You know, car's been in Australia since 1994, so Sports Car Connection at St. Mary's bought it in. So
1994. Was that the place that got done for smuggling drugs? Was that that place?
An import place in Adelaide. It got stunned for smuggling. I don't know.
Like, most import shops in the 90s. That was how it worked.
There was this place I remember because I used to go and watch the 36ers. And we used to, as we were going down towards the powerhouse back in the day, there was this import yard, and I used to see it all the time. When I used to go play basketball down that side of town and everything, we used to be driving around there. And there was this place that had this 308 California car, GDSI, converted left to right-hand drive. And it sat there for months and months and months and months and months and months. And I couldn't figure out how. And all their cars, they'd advertise in unique cars. Yep. And my Nono, he'd go through and buy unique cars and then give them to me. And I'd sit there and read through them like crazy. And, their stock would never change.
Yeah.
Stock would never change. And they had a whole bunch of, I vividly remember Dad and I one day, we stopped once, we'd never stopped in there. We went through there and we went out the back, and there was like 20 guys working out there and they're all pulling apart. And I vividly remember so many Porsche parts, like banks of gearboxes on the wall and like left-hand drive California 901s and stuff sitting there, all, you know, bits and pieces. And a lot of those like mid-80s with all the C2 kits on them and I couldn't figure out how they were like having all these people and all these parts that nothing ever changes.
Because the stock might never change, but what was available the luggage compartments.
So it wasn't that place.
Porsches do have a smuggler's box for a reason.
Maybe. Hang on. So I'll just bring up
I guess it's great the car never had the never got Ford dated. I guess while Luke's looking for pictures, I think it's funny that Ford dating was such a big thing back in the 80s and 90s. Everyone wanted their early Porsches to look like they're a new model. And now everyone has got SCs and the like are trying to backdate them to make them look like old ones. So,
Do you guys remember Joe's Golden Gasolines?
100%.
All that American stuff. And then every so often they'd end up with like a Porsche or a Ferrari or something.
Yeah,
and amongst a sea of Corvettes. And that was a time we just sound like a bunch of old cronies talking about.
Well, I actually had a Jap import. I had two Jap imports back in the day. I even worked at an import yard on weekends for a little bit of fun.
So out of interest, just while Luke's getting those pictures, why did you buy a Porsche? Because you were a familiar GTIR. You were blowing gearboxes up and drag racing people down in Port Adelaide and scene. How did you end up buying a bucket of bolts project Porsche?
Well, as I said, I've always been a car guy rather than just a particular brand. Like I've always had a soft spot for the Euro stuff and particularly Porsches. But a little bit of peer pressure. I think the familiar came around because a good family friend said, "Oh, you'd never buy a Jap import." And then, next day I'm like, oh, this familiar GDR thing's cool. And it was fun. But
three gearboxes later?
I was lucky. I never blew a box in it. I blew one front diff.
Yeah, that's not bad. All right, finally figured out, guys. Sorry for the delay on that. So
that's the photo I saw whilst having like morning tea at work, and I didn't actually realize it at the time. Everyone would say you were such a twat, but if you have a look at the screenshot, it was taken at 9:11.
Oh,
I'd never realized.
Did you Photoshop that?
100%. Yeah, it was. It's one of those serendipitous moments in life where you're just like, oh wow.
Yeah. Except you're a minute early.
I was a minute ahead,
but anyway.
Actually, that's something I really enjoy about Gons Labs' Instagram feed is he's always screenshotting, like, you know, 427 and 308. And
yeah, Gons Lab is a solid follow for those into mechanical coffee.
Love the Gons.
Yeah. So that's like first seeing it, and then yeah, obviously that picture there still on.
And I think what gave
a familiar site for it. Yeah, what are you saying, Andrew?
I was going to say that the wheels, I think that still sort of shows the end of the days when everyone was, you know, the biggest possible wheels and the newest, you know, I think having those large wheels, I think the change to the Steelies is definitely.
In the space of, those photos, it went from where it was to my mate's house to strip to tow truck to paint shop.
So it's a beautiful color.
How'd you come by the color? What made you decide?
So literally only had three choices when it came down to colors. One was to go to the original Polo red, and I'm not really a red Porsche fan. Resale red, as I call it, or sensible silver, two colors I don't really like on Porsches. Being a bit of a, being a Steve McQueen and a Le Mans fan, slate gray was high up on the list, but. Mm. As nice a color as slate gray is, it's a little bit bland. Like, this is a mid-60s car that's going to be loud. And I'm just like, it's got to be tangerine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll say Viper green or, Riviera blue for another one down the track another day, maybe.
Riviera blue. Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, that's definitely, I think the Viper green and a Riviera blue is definitely a more 90s, 2000s color. They wouldn't have suited, I don't think.
Yeah, I think 3 liter RS in Viper green and 993 RS CS Riviera blue, and I'd probably be a little happier than I am now.
But yeah, so we go through. So obviously this project sort of slowly coming together in various people's garages and sheds and whatnot.
Yep.
And then I guess I just want to touch on something that played out more recently, because, I feel like you were nearly there for so long. Like, you nearly had this car ready for so long. It was always like, I just need to do X, Y, Z. And this went on for a year.
Yeah.
And then finally, Xander's got it running. The car's finished. He just needs to get the tick, the registration plate, and then this project is done. And then I get a phone call from Luke saying, I don't think this is public knowledge, but Xander just told me this and I nearly fell on the floor. So do you want to...
Well, you weren't here for the exciting finishing part. I was so pumped to get in this car and go cruise and see what it's all about and see all these years of hard labor. And then
the final hurdle.
And then the phone call happens. So,
I kept saying for a long time, it was probably 2 years, like it needs 40 hours worth of work and like one more list of parts. So, three lists of parts later and about 120 plus hours worth of labor. It got there. So took the car to Buick's where the guys had looked after me and, let's get it engineered. That wasn't a problem. Let's tick off the last few little jobs. Got that done. And they say to me, yep, the car's ready. Like, let's do this. I'm pumped. I'm like, cool, we're going to do this the easy way. You guys are going to take the car through Regency. I'm going to take the day off work.
Just to interrupt, Regency Park, for those who don't know, is the vehicle inspection place in Adelaide, the government vehicle inspection. And unlike, it's a bit of a different system to the UK. So in the UK and Europe, you have your MOTs where they are done at any workshop you like, which is great if you know the workshop or the workshop have built the car themselves. Like, it's a much better system. But South Australia and most of Australia has a system where you need to take the car to the government and have their inspectors verify that it is road legal and safe. And it really is just, it's not a place you want to end up unless you can really avoid it, because especially if you've got an older car or a modified car and you get someone that's having a bad day, they can throw the book at you for just about anything they want. And so...
I don't know. I've been... I've been there twice. once for too loud exhaust. If anyone in Adelaide remembers Exhaust Technology and Marky Mark, know why I got defected. Being the young, naive person that I was, I'd have had an Alpha 3316 valve when I went.
With the Canon. Did you have the Canon?
No, I didn't have the Canon. That was Cat's Kid. I didn't have a Jumbia. I just had the Marky Mark Special. I went there and I said to Mark, because we lived literally, the end of street was Mark's shop.
Was Exhaust Technology back then.
Yeah, it was like everyone went there. And so I'd catch the bus after school and end up at Marky Mark's and have a chat to him while he's sitting there welding exhaust up. And when I got my first Fiat, he put an exhaust on that. I came back to him with my 16 valve.
Did you walk through the door and say, I would like you to make this as loud as possible for as much money as possible?
So I said to Mark, I don't want the car as loud as a Fiat, because that was really loud. I got in lots of trouble with neighbors and, you know, hear me coming down the street 4 kilometers away and everything. He goes, don't worry. Yeah, I'll look after you. I'll sort it out. Don't worry. Come back tomorrow. I'll have it sorted. And then come back tomorrow. And it's one hot dog and straight pipe. So it was extremely loud. And I got defected and ended up at Regency. But to their defense, I've had to bring a car from interstate, and I've also had to have the defect listed. And both times I've had a really good experience with them. The guys were really friendly. When I took the exhaust one through, I was to replace some suspension bits and didn't do up one of the ball joints properly. So he's like, oh, there's a spanner in the box over there. Just go grab it. And
but I mean, that's how it should be, right?
Fix it up.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry to segue off your thing.
That's a good example of how it should be done. And I think that's probably a good segue for the story. So, take the day off work. Get down to Buick's, absolutely pumped. Like, I haven't even been in this car at all. Haven't been in the passenger ride, haven't gone for a drive in it. And, you know, we're like, yep.
Yeah, because you got them to drive it down. So you were following the car
to
Regency, watching your car being driven.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't comprehend. Like, I was like, you didn't drive your car, you nuts. Mate, I would have been like kicking people out.
When I got my Fiat started after its restoration, I drove around the block with no windscreen and no interior, sitting in a mirror. So I didn't drive it. I don't know how you can wait. But anyway,
I'd been there, done that many times. I just wanted this to. Yeah. I just wanted it done. And we'd had nice weather, and of course, this day it's raining. This car hasn't seen rain. Not that I care about it now, but this car hasn't seen rain. And I'm like, oh man, don't tell me this is one of those signs. So sure enough, it's raining. And then they ring me. We're stuck on the side of the road. I'm like, what do you mean you're stuck on the side of the road? They're like, the brakes have locked on. I'm like, the what? They're like, yeah, it's not driving. Something's not right. So managed to get them to come out of their service van, jacked it up, bled the brakes. I think basically because everything was new, the rear calipers are just stuck on. Bled the brakes, all good, get to Regency. I'm just sitting back quietly, and I probably knew I was in trouble when the inspector came over and went,
sir, I can't find a Porsche 216 in the system.
I'm like, it's a 912, mate. The badge is upside down. So I knew I was probably not going to have a good day from that.
Do you get that a lot? Like,
yeah, I get a lot of people say, what's the deal with the 216 or the front GTS badge? Like, it's an upside down 912 badge, is my way of saying, yeah, look, it's not 912, it's not 911, and it's not pure. So, yeah. And anyway, for those who know 911s that have been converted, when they do it, they weld in a new, it's sort of like an upper floor panel that sits above the smuggler's box and goes from the left guard to the right guard underneath the hood at the front. And in the corner of that, it's got the chassis number. So if you put a whole new one in when you do the conversion, you're going to lose the chassis number. So being smart, you don't want to lose the chassis number, right? So they cut around it, and then they cut the corresponding slot in the new panel and then butt weld it together. So everything looks like it's supposed to, noting that it's not the only spot the chassis number's in the car. Anyway, they come over and they go, sir, if you could just come this way to our office, which is just an ACCO hut. I sit there, 30-year-old chair. They're sitting the other side of me, and they're like,
sir, under section 114B of the Motor Vehicle Act, we need to advise that we're impounding your vehicle.
I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. Can you tell me why?
How did you not jump up and destroy everything. I would have been, throw things around.
It's funny because I reckon seven year ago, Xander probably would have flipped the desk or, 76 kilos of me. But something, it's just sort of like, you know what, whatever. I've been through 7 years of ups and downs with this car that, it is what it is. So I'm like, all right, well, can you tell me what the issue is? Is it stolen? Do I need to ring the previous owner? Like, what's the issue?
No, it's a police matter now.
And I'm like, oh, here we go. So I'm like, all right, what happens? Oh, we tow your car to Ottaway. I'm like, oh, great, Ottaway, crack capital of South Australia. This car's just going to be like sitting outside. So grab my gear, told the mechanic what's going on. He's mortified. He's like, what the, what? He just couldn't believe it. I'm paying this guy by the hour as well. But so anyway, drop him back. I rang a lawyer friend of mine. I'm like, dude, this has just happened. He's like, that's not cool. Provide me all the stories. I'll try and get on to SAPOL, see what we can do.
Because what are maybe you telling me is that they just wouldn't give you a reason.
Yeah, wouldn't give me a reason. Like
none whatsoever.
You
couldn't go like, hey, did I not put something on right?
Is that upside down badge? Is that offensive?
Maybe they were just so offended by the idea of a 912 converted that they were we're just.
And this car's engineered, so it's got engineering paperwork to say it is what it is. The guy acknowledges in the engineer paperwork that it's been converted and meets all the standards. OEM parts have been used, all that sort of stuff. Mm. I think what put me out the most though is that it's sitting at Ottaway, potentially outside, and it's a minimum of 2 weeks before SAPOL, so SA Police get to look at it. And that's what I wanted to try and speed up. I'm like, A, I want this car inside, and B, I want to know why you guys are taking an issue with it. So anyway, fast forward, SAPOL finally get to the car. I get a phone call from an awesome police officer who's like, mate, firstly, beautiful car. Secondly, I don't know why it's here. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a converted car. Of course, they've had to cut and weld around and leave the original chassis number intact, so it's still got a chassis number. You can have your car back. So, put the car back on the tow truck, back to the workshop, because it's been sitting for almost 3 weeks. It's probably got a flat battery or whatever. So just, we go over it once again and I'm like, right, awesome. Book another date.
Yeah, because it's still not passed at that point.
Yeah, it's still not passed.
It's like they started the inspection and then
They didn't even start the inspection.
Well, they didn't even start. They must have done something.
What would have been awesome would be like, right, we're not happy that we don't know why there's, a cut and shut on this around this number. But hey, we'll put through, we'll do the full inspection anyway, because you're booked in and you've already paid for it.
Yeah.
And that way, if there's anything that's wrong with it, at least you can try and sort that out before it comes back. So of course they don't do that. No. So anyway, literally Groundhog Day, except no rain this time. The brakes did stick on again. but we got that sorted. It happened closer to the workshop this time, luckily. But yeah, got the car.
Were they the ones that you rebuilt?
No.
Oh, that's good. Thanks.
Got it back down there. And I thought this was hilarious. I'm going to tell the story. Old mate rocks up. Oh, firstly, they're like, oh, you need to stamp a police number onto a chassis plate. So if it ever becomes an issue again, like we know the history of it, they're like, just take to the body somewhere and just hammer in these numbers, which you can't do. There's nowhere in the front of the car you can do that. So I'm like, right, back in the import days, we used to have them printed on a piece of alloy and we'd pop rivet it onto the body. Oh, no, you can't do that. I'm like, well, we have to do something like that. And he's like, oh, you need to do blind rivets. I'm like, okay, blind rivets. How the hell are we going to do blind rivets with half an hour to go? Crash shop across the road helped us out. And he's like, mate, you can drill these off just as easy as you can. Normal rivets. He's got to send a punch.
Explain the blind rivet.
So a blind rivet just doesn't have the internal hole like a normal pop rivet has. Anyway, got it done, get it down there. Old mate's one of the guys from last time and he comes out and he's just got this air of arrogance to him. And he's like, you Porsche guys are all the same. I'm like, sorry? He's like, oh, always causing issues. I'm like, sure, mate. I'm like, look, I've done what you guys want. It's all fine.
I love doing this. This is my passion.
Yeah, and I said, look.
Because, the guys with Japanese imports never cause problems.
No, exactly. Or the
it's always the Porsche.
They've never done anything dodgy.
And I must have upset him because I sort of said, look, if we'd had an adult conversation at the time, we probably could have worked through this. Like there was no need for the aggravation, the time it's caused the police, everyone's wasted time. And that's when he's gone, oh, you Porsche guys are all the same. And as he's done that, he's spun around to say it and he's caught his clean shaven noggin right on the edge of the hood. And I've looked at the edge of the hood and you can see this ball of skin just on there. And you see the claret like dribbling down the side of his face. I look at the mechanic, he looks at me and I'm just like, don't look at him, Xander. Do not look at him. Like, you're going to get reamed. And then sure enough, we drove it from the ID station around for its full inspection and we did get reamed. They basically just, I'm not going to say that they were looking for things, but it got the full nine yards. It got the two fingers without the rubber glove. They really went to town on it. But, cool. I don't have an issue with that, right? They told me what things they wanted fixed. We took it back, fixed it, rebooked for a couple of weeks later. And it went through within 5 minutes. So, I am a safety first sort of person. So I'm happy with that.
Just for me, that period of, I remember those few weeks talking to you and just those of not knowing what's happened to your car that, like, let's be real. Like, even though, we're talking about money, but this is not an insignificant sum of money for anyone, but especially not for you or not. Like, it's a lot of cash to have sitting in a holding situation in a yard in an industrial area outside, not knowing what's going on, knowing if they're going to repossess it, if they're going to try and crush it, if they're going to do all of, I guess the possibilities running through your head must have just been
Like, if I just blow it, do I just have to tell my wife that what's probably close to $100,000 investment is just like disappeared and I haven't driven it? I think that was the biggest disappointment. Like,
and the funny thing is that you tried to do it properly. Like, with these old cars, it's really not hard to swap. I mean, you could have just swapped a chassis number and bolted some other plates on from a crash car and been driving no problems and never even gone out to see them.
I mean, everyone reckons they're just a Volkswagen anyway. So I could have bought a $500 bug from the trader and be like,
oh, no, that's a Volkswagen.
I painted it orange,
It's got a porker kit on it.
And look, I'm glad that it did work out. And last time I was back in Australia for the Adelaide Rally, we went out for a drive and spent a very enjoyable afternoon. And those photos hopefully are going to appear somewhere large on Instagram soon, which we were hoping. If it doesn't, they will be on Sportscar Safari. But that was just a really enjoyable afternoon. And I think having experienced it, I could definitely see it, for me at least anyway, I think it's worth the toil and the tears. It's a very cool car. And I think the funny thing that I find so exciting about it is if you parked it next to Stu K's 901, I take someone like my girlfriend or our wives or anyone, they would pick your car as the better car, the faster car, the better looking, the more expensive. Like yours looks like the cooler car, and it's cost and worth a fraction, like a tenth of his. So I think that's a really good achievement. I think it's really cool.
And that's one of the things I love about the car. Like, I think the first person I took out in it, other than my wife, was Luke.
Yeah.
And it then proceeded to tell me that its fuel gauge is inaccurate. And it wasn't a run out of fuel. Tell the story if you want, Luke.
It wasn't much of a big story, but we went out to a cars and coffee event at Norwood. And first time outing, I think we've got some pictures.
Awesome photos of it.
Yeah, we took a couple that day. Of it out on its first maiden voyage to an event. It went really well. Had a little bit of a knock from the gearbox.
Cool.
That was still there when I drove.
It's part of the problem when you start squeezing in, a 915 box into a short wheelbase body. Yeah. It doesn't quite fit 100%. Yeah. And, there's a few other little bits that are hot-rodded. Finessing required.
Yeah. Always. With a brand new build of an old car like that, it's pretty hard to get it right first time. It was really great. A little bit of a damp day. Yep. We kind of got out there a bit rainy. I was a bit upset the car got wet, actually, even though it wasn't my car.
It seems to happen.
This is basically where we ended up. So we ended up pulled over at a servo because Xander was a bit worried that we were going to run out of fuel.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? We was like, oh,
I'd only
no.
put $20 in it, I think, the first time I took it out. And I was like,
I had nothing else left in the bank after.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm like, I'm just going to, I was like, it might have been like 20 or 30 litres. I'm like, I've put some fuel in it. I better just put some more in just to be on the safe side. Because it was like, it was reading around quarter or less than quarter of a tank.
Yeah, and plus where Xander lives is uphill a bit. So, you know, we had to go up some inclines and stuff. And it was just one of those things, old car, not much fuel, bit of an unknown. We went and stopped, put some in. And, you know, so we both got out the car as you do and you're having a look around. And you saw a friend of yours, so we're having a chat with her. Yeah. And Xander filled it up and kind of brimmed it up. And then Xander proceeded to go and pay, and I was left staring at this car and then wondering why there was something other than water pouring out of the front of the car.
It's always strange when an actual car's leaking water. Because it wasn't water.
No, it wasn't water. And then, of course, that smell of, like, strong smell of petrol came out. I went,
Xander. Wasn't any old petrol. It was OTR BP petrol.
So, you know, well, that's worth
that came leaking out, and we kind of investigated it and figured out it was just pouring out the top of the sender unit. So
The sender unit sits slightly below the actual top of the tank.
Yeah, it kind of recesses in a little bit.
That's a good ritual, because the same thing happened with my Fiat X19 up on its first drive. That you know, you start a restoration project and you're full of hope and you're full of, you know, what you think will be enough money, which turns out to be about a quarter of what you actually need. So so you start off going, I'm going to replace everything. Everything's going to be new. And then as the project gets closer, you start looking, you're like, yeah, no, that can go back on. And I did the same with the Fiat. It has a little rubber flexible hose top. And then I brimmed it for the first drive. And of course it was cracked and proceeded to, first time big puddle in the forecourt of the, it's not a nice feeling, but
no.
So now I fix the problem by I just don't brim the Fiat anymore. So problem solved.
Then we proceeded to muck around with all manners of trying to extract some fuel out of the tank.
Yep.
And had some help.
Yep. I think you tried to drink it.
I tried to drink it. You tried to drink it.
Your dad tried to drink it.
Dad tried to drink it. It was pretty horrible.
A lot can be said for a $5 jiggler. Another one of our Porsche friends didn't live too far away, and a car I've actually been service crew on for a couple of years, and he returned
by service crewing us.
Yeah. and $10 gaskets are on the top of the tank, and I've got this new philosophy of the car now. If it needs a part and it's under $1,000, it's like, just do it. So I bought a new sender unit thinking, the sender unit's probably not great, and got the gauge tested. Gauge came back fine. So I'm like, it must've been the sender. Put the new sender in, and guess what? It's no different. So if anyone wants to buy a secondhand sender, hit me up. I'll do a good price on it.
Yeah, it's just one of those things with that era of car.
The thing I love,
no distance to empty or anything. It's just, you know what? Just make sure we put fuel in it.
Yeah.
Like every time you're going
to
drive
the right fuel thing, I was trying not to run out. And
the thing I love about old cars is like, you talk to even, you know, here in the UK, you know, some of the Ferrari restorers that do these incredible cars, and, you know, and even they admit that after you spend hundreds of thousands of pounds restoring your Daytona, and it's just this incredible thing that looks amazing on Instagram, it's still a little bit shit. Like, stuff still happens. It's great.
I picked up a good friend of mine who'd been there when I bought the car and picked it up, and taken him for a drive, you know, like I did with you and Luke. And I remember 5 minutes down the road from his house, and he's like, man, it's good to see you throw $100,000 at a 50-year-old car, and it's still a 50-year-old car.
Yeah. So I guess now, so we've got the happy 911, and I guess it's a good part. It's more of a conversation for you two, but historic go-kart racing. Let's flip this on its head. Can see what's behind you there.
Give it a little bit of room, so let's see.
Yeah.
Interestingly, not my car.
So it's funny. I was talking to you guys about podcasts the other day. I'm like, oh, what podcasts are good? You know, I'm 10 years late on listening to podcasts, and I reckon it was about 10 years ago. And
speaking of podcasts, can I just interrupt there for a second? I feel old listening to podcasts now, because I kind of feel like it's the new AM radio. Like, you're listening to talk back, right? But it's a podcast, so it's cool.
I just want to complain about the daylight savings and my curtains.
Yeah, there's no old people.
So the funny thing, when Xander discovered podcasts, I still remember it was like that Family Guy moment with Quagmire. It's like, wait, there's porn on the internet? Like, what? There's podcasts? There's cars? Right.
There's podcasts, yeah. So anyway, you were listening to
podcast. So I always seem to be like either well ahead of my time or behind my time with things. And I wanted to get into a historic go-kart because I've always loved historic racing. You know, I owned a historic Fiat Arbuff 850 TC race car that I never bought over from the UK.
Did you buy yours first or did I buy mine first?
I think you bought yours first and we just didn't realize it at the
time. Hang on, not mine, but we'll get to that. It's not mine.
And wanted to get a historic go-kart because obviously, you know, having a BT51 or something in the garage is unobtainable for the time being.
BT50s there for.
One of the get a go-kart, probably one of the buyer kart in the late 90s when I was at the end of my schooling. I thought, you know, it'd be cool to have a go in a kart. It was never a financially viable option. Historic go-karts. I'm like, yeah, they're a thing. Be cool to get one. Asked around a few people. Most people are like, oh, I got rid of it, yada, yada. But a friend of mine, someone you know as well, Alan, was right into them and kept picking his brain. Oh, you know, what about this one? He's like, nah, that's probably not what you want, or it's not eligible, or it's too expensive. And it got to the point where Alan was just like, why don't you just buy one of mine? I'm like, okay, done. So he was down locally visiting one of his sons, and he's like, yeah, I'll be down next weekend. Come get the cart. I'm like, does it fit in a 6x4 trailer? Because I've got nothing else. He's like, yeah, you'll be right. Typical Alan, you'll be right. So rock up and, Gumaraka, like 8 o'clock at night. And I told my beautiful wife at about 7 o'clock that night, I'm like, hey, I just got to pop out tonight and pick up a go-kart. And I could tell at that time that maybe I probably should have consulted with her before I bought the go-kart. Noting, I think she was pregnant at the time. So I told her that this go-kart's probably going to be for our first child, but we didn't even know if it was going to be a boy or a girl. Buy this go-kart. She asked how much it was. I told her a figure and she was flabbergasted at the cost. Go pick up this go-kart, bring it home. I'm all happy. Got no idea about anything to do with proper go-karts, you know.
Because they're proper stuff. Like, I mean, I used to race karts back in the day, very brief and broadly unsuccessful stint in them. But, like even starting them, like no starters, you know.
No starters.
They're loud. They're very smelly. It's a lot of, yeah.
So, yeah, we're talking, you know, proper CIK go-karts, so 84 Swiss Heartless winner, Rotax DSB. So, you know, 16 to 18,000 RPM on a rotary valve motor. Great thing. So, bought this thing. Now, Alan's all about performance and not presentation. So it came with about 20 kilos of Ballarat dirt and, you know, every nut and bolt was mismatched, but all the stuff that mattered was there. So finally took it out, you know, joined up, took it out to the track, met some really cool dudes there. It's what I love about any form of historic motorsport. Most people aren't racing for sheep stations because they already own them. These guys were just really chilled, like, yeah, hey man, you know, you've just halved the average age of the club sort of thing. You know, you need to do this, you need to do that. It was really good. And I sort of wussed out a little bit on like, hey, does one of you guys want to take this card out and just give it a shakedown and make sure it's good? And they're like, yeah, no probs. And they're looking at it and they're like, oh, you haven't got any Nylock nuts. I'm like, yeah, I hate Nylock nuts. They're hard to use. I just, you know, went and bought these new stainless ones and like, you're probably going to lose half of them. I'm like, what? So, you know, welcome to the world of go-karts real quick. It shook out 80% of all these brand new stainless and bolts because there was no Nylock. So anyway, they took it out, gave it a couple of laps, tweaked the carby a bit, gave it a couple more, tweaked the carby a bit more. And they're like, right, take it out. Good to go. I'm like, cool. So I've driven a couple of relatively okay karts before, but never a proper sort of race car. And I've hopped into this thing and I was like, oh my God, it, you know, I've flown a Hornet before. And it was almost like flying off.
Hang on. Go back
to that.
You've been in a Hornet?
Yeah, I've flown a Hornet. We'll talk about the Hornet later. That was the closest experience to like flying a Hornet. This thing was proper fast and great fun. Like, couldn't wipe the smile off my face. So,
The first time I drove like a serious car, I think everyone that's done it has this memory of you've only driven hire cars before, and the first time you put your foot down and it actually moves, it's like, whoa. And then the other thing is like out at the track,
you know? Guys use, can I get some of them for arm pump? It made a difference. That was great fun. So I took it home, tidied it up, slow motion, and it was just I was so pissed off with myself, and then it twigged. the first time I'd driven the car, it had already gone through three heat cycles. So although the tires were cold, they were still warm, where this was stone cold, like off the back of the trailer.
So
I got better as the day got on. I think I only missed out on the top four shootout by about half a second, which is, you know, for someone that's who's second time out in that car, it's pretty good. Yeah.
It's not bad. Yeah. Well, whenever we've gone out doing like hire cars together, like you've always been quick.
We've had some good times, haven't we, Colsey?
But the thing I guess that makes karting so attractive as opposed to regular motorsport is, I don't know if this is still the case, but if you join the Bolivar Club, you actually get a key to the track, don't you? And you can go 100%. Out there anytime and just go and cut some laps. You don't need to pay for an event or anything. You just
correct
just
go and actually
have a spin. Like, that's great. That's
it works out cheaper for me to go out there like two or three times a year than what we'd spend on a social night of karting, which is just crazy. I just need to, I mean, it's crossroad from my work. I need to go more often. It's so silly I don't. But the reason I don't is because I really don't have someone in my friendship group and age who's got a, oh, wait a minute, Luke, you've got a go-kart.
No, he doesn't.
No, you don't. Samuel has a go-kart.
My son has a go-kart.
So tell us about your cart, Luke.
hang on. Who's running this really podcast? Yeah. Come on,
tell us about your go-kart, Luke.
My son's go-kart. So the story with that, I have a son called Samuel. He is 8 years old now. And from really early on, literally from when he came home, we were watching Formula One together and doing bits and pieces. And I was trying to brainwash him into loving cars, as any good car loving father tries to do, and just everything was cars. And I managed to convince my wife that a really good idea for his fifth birthday present was a go-kart. And mind you, how do you have to be Xander to do kids? I think it's like seven.
So you can, I think you start like practicing at six, racing at seven, but historic karts in a ladder race until you're 15.
Yeah, exactly. So this was like, he was well too young for anything, but I thought, buy it early and whatever. And Ruth was reluctant to spend tons of money, obviously, is because you can go down a pretty deep hole. And I told my wife about it.
Yeah, but you also paid a third of what I paid for mine.
So anyway, I said to Ruth, look, I'll hunt around, do Gumtree, do Facebook Marketplace, see what we can find. I'm sure there's something out there cheap, because there's lots of people that get into karting for their kids and their kids hate it. Stop and don't want to do it and whatever. So,
and I'll just point out now that historic go-karting almost seems to be linked to the Porsche curve and bubble, because something that used to be unloved once they were, you couldn't race them anymore, didn't have a class and just sat by the wayside.
Well, I think that's maybe
now gained popularity.
I think that's maybe when I got mine, before that kind of happened. I'm running around finding stuff. I'm seeing carts like, you know, $1,000, $1,500, and Ruth's going, no, too much. I'm going, oh, come on, it's fine. Let's just buy one that's good. No, buy one cheaper and then you guys can work on it together. So anyway, I found this cart, in the northern suburbs of Adelaide, and it was pretty cheap. It was $450, I think it was listed for. And
good size, not bad.
And the guy said it was a junior car, and it had a KT100J on it. So it's got the 100J engine, which is the one that was made for junior classes, and the proper old one. But I didn't know that at the time, because again, same like Xander, I knew nothing about historic cars. I just saw a cart that was junior and went, great, we're in. This is perfect. We'll be able to get this for Samuel. He'll love it. We'll work on it, fix it, get it run. The cart didn't run, hadn't run. The guy said, you know, the seat was a bit small for him and he couldn't fit in it, so he just didn't do anything with it. It didn't have a petrol tank in it at the time or anything as well. So I've gone out there, seen the cart, offered him money for it. He took it. I brought it home, which was great. Samuel opened it on his birthday, loved it, had an absolute, like, you know, we worked on it together, got the thing running, but it was way too big for him. And when I went to go buy it, it was like pretty much the right, like I was like, oh, I can barely fit in it. Surely this five-year-old kid, it'll fit him perfectly. Nah, way too big. So we pushed him around the yard in, and if you go to my Instagram, there's some video of me pushing him around the front yard of our place, and, you know, I pulled off the engine chain so that we could push him around the yard, and he had an absolute ball in it. Then I decided to look into it a bit more, and I think it was talking to you.
Yeah, I think I was the one that sort of said to you, oh, that's right, there was a guy out at Bolivar had one that had the same chassis, and I was like, dude,
I think this is your cart. Yeah. So we ended up looking at it. It turns out it's a 1986 87 Arrow A6 historic car. So it's actually an adult cart. It's just, I don't know if it's like houses, you know, they were always smaller, older. The carts were a little bit smaller than what the newer ones are. And yeah, so it turns out I bought Samuel a car that is not fit for him and he can't do anything with. So,
but he can learn how to spanner and set it up.
Yeah, he can learn how to spanner.
So dad could go and drive it.
Xander's been pushing me hard to try and get some. It came with these horrible yellow, like 90s side pods on it.
Yeah.
That probably is what threw me off to it being a historic car. So they'll probably put on to comply with regs at some point in the 90s.
Yeah, I think it was competitive. Yeah. Early 90s from memory.
Yeah. So anyway, you can buy the side chrome bars for them. So they're just a thin bit of chrome and they look mint. So I'm still treading that water of trying to convince my 8-year-old son that daddy should go and drive his car, even though he can't go in it. So we'll see how that goes.
You could do the bait and switch, buy him another one and say, I got you a new one.
I floated that with Ruth, but that was it. Well, if he can't use his cart that you bought him for his birthday, then you should sell it and buy one that he can use.
I'll buy it.
I'm always up for another one. Be like the vinyl cut machine. I'll pay for it. Just stay here.
Stick it, sit in my shed.
Yeah, but you could use it though.
Yeah. I think it'd be an interesting thing. It's kind of like the circuit sprinting where you're not doing door-to-door racing, you can't
race era fours with each other. You have to do time trials with them, which is still fun though. Like you can be on the track and you can follow someone. I did Mount Gambier earlier in the year. It was good just to follow people, you know, three cart lengths behind. It was good.
So Xander, tell me in the historic karting scene, because I think this is actually a big opportunity, because a lot of people want to go historic racing, but at the end of the day, the cost of building a competitive car is crazy. Then you have tires, you need a massive workshop to work on it, you need a trailer, you need a tow car. Like, it's a big investment, whereas a historic cart that you could, you know, put on a roof rack and take out is really it's just a really attractive proposition. But is there scope for someone like ourselves who likes to indulge in, you know, the finer foods and beers of the world, and is maybe a few kilos heavier than, because I know that, you know, karting is very much like skill comes into it, but also the lightest person is the fastest person. So is there a scope for people that are not featherweight to, and I don't mean large, but you know what I mean? Like, is it that competitive?
Well, I guess because you're racing against the clock, you know, yeah, you probably are at a disadvantage if you're heavier and you're not technically supposed to do weight adjustment. So you could basically get everyone to stand on the scales and then apply a formula to it to do a weight adjustment and change their times accordingly. But most of the people are just doing it for fun. So I was lucky enough, a guy gave me a brand new set of tires. I'm like, why are you giving these to me? And he's like, oh, these are the MG red whites. I only use yellows because I'm trying to knock, you know, 0.01 off my PB, and I won't do it with these tires.
Okay, so it's serious,
but he doesn't care who beats him. He has a time in mind and he wants to beat that time.
Yeah.
So yeah, no one ever goes, oh, I beat you. You know, what time did you do? Everyone's just out there having fun. You know, to the point at Mount Gambier, it was supposed to be a 2-day event. The Saturday got washed out. Hardly anyone put transponders on their carts on the Friday. So everyone left there not knowing what time they'd done, but everyone left with a massive smile going, well, that was fun.
Yeah. I guess that's similar to MSCA sprints and, you know, track days that they've done and that, you know, Andrew and I have raced over the years. And they actually ran one on Sunday,
but I mean,
which was a bit tight. But
if the followers want to have a look at Retro Karting Australia, RKA, that's a whole bunch of guys who, you know, used to race back in the day, kept their carts, and they're out there tire to tire.
The OGs.
Absolutely. Like late 90s, early 2000 carts. And they're spending good money to do it too.
But having said that, like a cart like the one that I bought, an Arrow A6, which is a Era 4 kart, which runs, you know, Yamaha 100.
Yep, you can run my Rotax on it as well.
Yeah, you can run Rotax on them. You know, they're like on that Facebook group that we're on, you know, the historic kart group, you know, they're on for $1,000 or $1,200. Like, they're not an overly expensive kart to just purchase and jump in and go cut some laps, which is,
you could probably buy yourself a nice, you know, restored Tony kart or a Swiss Heartless for, you know, $2,500-$3,000, something with, you know, probably a Rotax on it. And yeah, you'd be going probably, if you've never driven one before, you'd be going quicker than you need to go.
Fantastic.
And, you know, set of tires, $250 last year. A year if you go out a couple of times, so certainly cheaper than, and you know, fuel, it's got like a it's like a 5 liter fuel tank, so your arms will drop off before you'll use 10 liters of fuel in a race weekend.
Xander can attest to this as well, because we were actually just talking about it prior to coming on the podcast and going live, was and I noticed this when I bought the cart, is having proper two-stroke race oil in your fuel, and then using that because you've got lawnmower. It sitting there in the lawnmower, and that is
glorious.
Just, you're sitting there and you're mowing the lawns, and all you can smell is this beautiful castor oil.
Well, as I was saying, that I've just picked up this this old Vespa 1978 150 Super, and I'm definitely going to be. I don't even have a go kart, and I'm going to be running that on go kart race fuel. I think the fine people of the city of Cambridge will love the scent of castor oil race fuel on a Sunday morning.
Are you a mod or a rocker, Andrew?
Amor la dolce vita.
I think even Andrew's fiance Chantel might like the smell of the fuel too.
We can only hope.
So where did you get this Vespa running, Andrew? Where, tell us the story about that quick. We got a few more minutes. Well, we're up.
A few more minutes. We're wrapping up.
How much longer do you want to go for? Like,
I think we're getting good. We're getting close. But
we can talk about the trip to the States.
Oh yeah, yes, yeah.
And the Hornet.
Andrew, quickly get through your quick.
Yeah, so basically I had an opportunity to purchase this Vespa 1978 150 Super. Hasn't run for 4 or 5 years. And but the problem is, for anyone who's been to the UK and spent much time here, you realize that actually, unlike Australia, garage space really is a premium, and it's quite a privilege, and we live in a lovely part of Cambridge, but we're not blessed with a garage or anywhere to keep. So the rule was that the Vespa's going to have to live in the kitchen. That's just the only way it's going to work. So I thought we'd try it. So the first hurdle was to get it in. It was a non-runner, but to put it there and see if it got in the way. And we lived for a few weeks, and it's fine.
In the kitchen,
well, there's nowhere else to put it.
I mean, I get in trouble if I'm like, stuff, and I'm going to put it in the shed. And Ruth's like,
Italian stuff's in the kitchen, though.
Yeah. So we got it running, and then of course there was a blockage in the fuel system, because two stroke's been sitting for 4 or 5 years. It's just turned in the oil, fuel has evaporated away, the oil's turned into a muddy cake. So there was a few weeks of trying to, you know, the carburetor apart, pull the fuel tap apart, trying to work this out. And there was one day when I went out to get some stuff in town, and I accidentally left the fuel tap on with the fuel hose disconnected from the carburetor.
His face is just gone.
Complete mistake. And I've come back sort of, luckily Diatel was at work that day, and I came back a couple of hours later, and the house reeked of fuel, and there was a big puddle of fuel under the car and under the fridge. So I'd open the windows up, clean it up. Anyway, long story short, got it running the other day. Have gone for a short ride, which I probably shouldn't have done. I don't have a motorcycle license here.
You can't lose if you haven't got it.
Allegedly, I don't have one. But that's the plan. But of course, I would be going to get my license. But of course, in the UK, we're in lockdown now. Yeah. And group classes to teach motorcycle lessons, surprisingly, are classed as a non-essential service. So yeah, they are not running at the moment.
So let's get back to Hornet. Like, you say Hornet, and like, what? Yeah, well, because, I mean, you work. Tell people what you do for a job.
It's funny you should say that, because I was talking to Jordan Roddy, noting he was on lockdown. I'm like, hey, dude, here's a question, two parts. What's the smallest engine you've ever owned? And what's the largest? Yeah. It's like, well, the largest is the Viper and the smallest is this 80cc, you know, motorbike I'm building whilst I'm in lockdown on the farm. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah. I'm like, you're a pilot. You'll appreciate these figures. Like, you know, tell me what it is. Yeah. And I was like, you know, 27,000 kilos of thrust or whatever by two engines, max speed 2,200 kilometers an hour. And he's like, Hornet. I'm like, man, you are clever. And
we need to get him on the podcast.
Yeah, if you're listening.
If you watch this, hit us up. We'll hit you up, believe us.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, those things are pretty cool. You know, it's pretty cool to fly one. And he's like, what? I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I've flown a Hornet, just like you guys said before. So my day job, I'm in the Air Force, and I was lucky enough in my first posting that when I went to leave the location, they're like, hey, would you like to fly a Hornet? And of course I said, yeah. I'd done a few hours in the sim with the pilots on a Friday, which is always a bit of fun. Got to fly a Hornet, and it's insane. Like, I was totally nervous. Like, I'm a nervous person at the best of times, and I did not want to be sick in this plane, and did not want to miss out on the opportunity. So, you know, I'm in the Northern Territory at the time, so it's stinking hot. You're in a G suit and you walk like a cowboy because it does squeeze your legs. Like, it's designed to keep the blood in the right spot. So you sort of swagger out to the plane and you strap in, and it's not a quick process. So you're sitting on the ground probably for half an hour, getting really hot while you're doing the systems checks, no aircon. And you know, the pilot briefed me, he's like, right, we're just going to roll down the runway, take off, we'll climb up over the right hand shoulder and we'll climb up and then I'll hand over to you. I'm like, yeah, cool, sounds good. And this is a clean jet. So a clean jet means no pylons, no missiles, no tanks, anything like that. So it's like taking a Formula One car out in qualifying mode. You know, you got the best tires, best engine, right? Super Leggera. Yeah, it's a super Leggera. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we're rolling down the runway and I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. Like, this is pushing me back in the seat more than a, you know, 10-second car or a 12-second car does. Like, there's definitely some thrust behind you. And we rotate, and then you hear the gear go up into the bay and you hear the door go clunk. And the next minute, I remember trying to get my hands up onto the canopy grab rails as I'm sort of like, like when you're swimming in the torrents and you can't see anything. Like, it was almost like that. So I'm trying to hold on, and we're climbing up and get to 30,000 feet. And he hands over, he's like, it's yours now. I'm like, yeah, cool. And I'm like, what sort of G's did we pull? And I think it was something like, you know, it was like around about six and a half G. Which is, explaining why I was pretty much graying out. He's like, you're in command, do what you want. And I'm sitting there, I'm just holding onto the stick, looking around. I'm like, wow, I'm in a Hornet, I'm in the air. Yeah. And he's like, he's like, how's it going? I'm like, yeah, good. He's like, you going to do something? I'm like, yeah, maybe. What should I do? And he's like, well, you've climbed 3,000 feet since I handed it over to you. And I'm like, yeah, nuts. Wow. Like, there's nothing, like, you know, it's not like driving in peak hour traffic. There's no signs. There's sort of no trees. There's no one else at 30,000 feet. You're just in this clear blue sky. He's like, do a roll. I'm like, okay. So slap the stick hard against my left knee, like I would in the sim. But you got to understand, this sim was, you know, it's probably like a third gen sim. It's a bit like playing PS1 on Gran Turismo. You know, you're not moving the screens to sort of invert you. But when you're in the plane and you roll, like, it's insane. Like, it just smashed your body. Yeah, so did that.
Did you have any trouble working out where the horizon was, like coming back to, like, to know when you've done 360 degrees or?
No, it happens that quickly. It sort of brings you straight back to where you are. Like, it wasn't a pretty maneuver. Like, if, you know, if you're an Olympic diver, you probably would have got about six for it because, you know, technique could have been a bit better. Yeah, it's just insane. Absolute respect for those guys. Like, it does smash you. And, you know, did a little bit more flying. And I said, oh, look, can we break the speed of sound? Because I'd love, you know, when we're sitting around talking and you guys are like, yeah, you know, I did a track day and did 180. Like, it was pretty cool. I just want to be that guy's like, done the speed of sound.
Yeah, Not many people can say that.
So yeah, we got to do that. And definitely that was a bucket list. Because I always wanted to be a pilot when I was a kid. And school maths results probably suggested otherwise. And I have no regrets. I'm not a pilot, to be honest. There's a lot of people who are really cut out to do it, and I work with them every day. And their ability to process things is insane.
Well, even I mean, fighter pilots are again, but you know, Guy Standen, who I've co-driven for in the rally, to watch him process data and information and take and also like the analysis of risk. I know that Luke and I are very much like, you know what, just wing it. She'll be fine. She'll be right. Yep. But he's very much risk analysis, planning multiple outcomes, thinking the whole time about all these different eventualities, and it's a whole nother mental level.
Yeah. I think anyone can fly, and potentially it's almost easier than driving a car, but it's the processing of multiple different courses of action, or like the what ifs, like what if this happens, or this has now happened, how do I do this whilst doing this, and then, you know, throw a fighter pilot mentality in there of I've got to try and drop a bomb on him, he's trying to shoot me, oh now I've got this warning, and they just process it like you know, we're ordering a coffee. Oh, you know, there's two different cakes, and you're like, oh, which cake do I want? These guys are all over it. So
yeah. So just quickly, I guess we'd probably need to wrap up shortly. But your time, you know, so work took you to Florida, and you're hanging out with that really cool group of Porsche guys in Florida with the 356s and heading out to Sebring and whatnot. Like, just
so Florida was funny. Like, the opportunity came up to do a course in Florida. And I sort of, you know, freshly married, freshly bought a house. It was a 3-month stint away. And I'm like, man, that's
Porsche
a long
restoration.
Time. Porsche restoration. And I had a quick look at the calendar and I was like, what's on? Like, firstly, where am I going in Florida and what's on? And it worked out, but I was going to be in Florida for the Rolex 24 hour, the Daytona 500, Amelia Island Concours, and the Sebring 12 hour. So, they didn't really have to sell it to me too much. So I've rolled in there, gone to Rolex for the 24 hour, and it's insane. Like, makes Clipsal 500 look like a club event at Malala. Like, everywhere you can sign in with an iPad, put an email address, and you're walking away with hats and t-shirts and posters. And, you know, I see this oldish looking guy and I'm like, you look vaguely familiar. And he had that, you know, when you know a motorsport driver just by that sort of like that again, that swagger, that attitude. I'm
the
like
aura of them.
Yeah, I'm like, who are you? And then it clicked. It was Brian Redman. And there's no one standing next to Brian. So I'm just like, oh dude, massive fan. He's like, yeah, you know, signs a poster for me. And I'm like, wow, that was cool. So anyway, did Rolex 24 hour, it was great. And sitting on Craigslist, so you know, American Gumtree. Mm-hmm. And for the Porsche people, everyone would know Jacksonville, Florida, home of Broom Ross, Hurley Haywood, Peter Gregg, like massive Porsche thing. And just searching Brumos. I think I was might have even just been searching Porsche, and all this Brumos stuff comes up. And I was like, wow, man, that's cool. I'm like, I'm going to buy it. So I hit up the guy. I'm like, hey, can I catch up and buy this stuff? And, you know, we're so naive in Australia. If you buy something off Gumtree, you go to someone's house and you buy it and you probably have a coffee or you become friends with them. In America, you do not go to their house. Like, it's a public car park. They want to do everything in public so no one gets shot. And I was like freaking out, like, oh, this guy wants to meet me in some corner. Like, I'm going to die.
Anyway, that's the opposite here.
Yeah, like, exactly.
If you're meeting someone in a corner, they're doing something dodgy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then you go to the house and they invite you side for a tea or a beer or something, then you know you're good.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, great old guy. He worked at he was a salesman for Brumos from pretty much day dot. He'd retired. Wow. He'd divorced, so he's having a bit of a cull. And you could see he had sentimental attachment to this stuff. So I was, you know, he wanted the money regardless, but I was trying to tell him it was going to go to a good home and, you know, was into this stuff and I wanted to collect it.
It's not going to, you know, end up on eBay.
Exactly.
For like four times what you bought.
And, you know, there was Deborah Gregg's race suit and a helmet signed. Yeah, a helmet signed by Hurley Haywood. So we're talking about some solid stuff here. So put photos on Instagram and literally within seconds of pressing post, I get this DM. And it's this guy's like, wow, man, where'd you get this stuff? And I'm like, oh, you know, just bought it off Craigslist. He's like, oh, that's really cool. My dad was the parts manager for Brumos for 50 years, like did his whole career there. And we got talking. He's like, oh, I'd love to catch up. And I'm like, oh, here we go. This is a bit where I'm going to get shot. And he's like, oh, you know, like, oh, looking at your Instagram, it looks like you're from Australia. And I said, yeah, I'm in the Air Force. I'm over here for a course. He's like, oh, I'm a cop. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. No, damn, I'm going to get shot. I'm going to get shot by a cop. But no, Robert's a really cool dude, and we caught up, and yeah, you know, like talking to you guys, but like I've known him for years. He's like, oh man, you got to meet my mate Chad. And I'm like, okay, this is where I'm going to get shot. Anyway, turns out Chad was a fiery and Chad was the coolest dude. I rock up at his house and I'm like, oh wow, this house is cool. And I realize it's not a house. It's a garage. His garage is like bigger than my house. So we get there and there's a 69 911T in Irish green, a white SC, a Rosewood SC, like the perfect 70s, you know, James Brown inspired color combo, split window bus and a split window ute. And Chad's just the coolest dude. And he's like, dude, just hang with me, man. Like, you know, he was going through a divorce. So wanted someone to hang out with. And we got talking and next thing he's like, hey man, you know, you need to meet Mark. So we go to Mark's place and we're driving these cars and Mark's like, hey man, don't tell anyone, but Magnus is going to be in town next weekend. And being the ultimate Porsche fan guy, like, Magnus. We catch up with Magnus and he's just the coolest dude. Like you could walk up to him and go, hey Magnus, I've got a hot pink 924 auto. And he'll be like, man, those 924 autos, they were the best auto gearbox out of all the gearboxes. Like he would just talk to anyone. He's not pretentious.
You know,
great sense of humor.
I can back that up. I've met Magnus twice.
You did? Yeah.
And the second time, obviously he wouldn't remember me from a bar of soap, but the second time I met him was at the Ace Cafe in London. He was having an outlaw gathering and we just had the first issue of Sports Car Safari was out and we thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool to, I think you might have even suggested it, like go and give one to Magnus. And so just went up and said, hey, and you know, gave him mag and he's like really cool, starts flicking through it and he's like, you know, and we got this photo of myself and Magnus together with our first issue of Sports Car Safari, and that was his idea. Like that was all his idea. He's like, come in, get a photo, you know, and he arranged that, and we probably spent, I mean, this was a like one of those just mornings, so there's a bunch of people and we probably spent 5 minutes chatting about stuff and cars, and he remembered you. He remembered at the time, I remember there was a plot to get him to come down under for the Adelaide Motorsport Festival at the time, and he knew of the festival.
So he came over to Australia for Rennsport because, as you know, I said to him when he was in the States, hey, next time we do Rennsport, do you want to come across? He's like, yeah, sure. You know, we talk, you've got my details, just let me know. Mm. And hit up a friend at Porsche Australia at the time. And next minute I know he's at Rennsport and I'm not.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. But no, very, very cool guy with passion and time for everyone. Yeah.
Yep. So you know, we did that. And then next day got up super early, hop in this 911T and we head out to Amelia Island, cars and coffee for their concourse. So, you know, you're on the 18th hole of, you know, Amelia Island golf course. And there's two singers just sitting there, you know. There was a 250 GTO recreation and the guys very quick to say, oh, sorry, it's just a recreation, but it's on a short wheelbase chassis. And it's just like, wow. So, you know, we hang with Magnus for a bit there. Jerry Seinfeld walks over because on the back of the split window combi, we've built this Brumos GT3 pedal car for Chad's daughter. And he's like, that's cool, man. Like, do you want a photo? And he's like, yeah, no, thanks. I was like, man, come on. he Seinfeld us pretty much. It was funny. The highlight of that, we end up at a guy called Bill Amos's hangar in Amelia Island. And his hangar's got, it's like a movie set inside. It's got a little bar. It's got a barber shop. It's just insane. And, you know, Bill's just chatting to us like, yeah, whatever. Next time you're in Amelia Island, pop in. Oh, yeah, I'll buy that Hurley Haywood helmet. That'd be great. Yeah, it's just awesome. And, you know, spoke some more to Magnus and then, you know, Sebring 12 hours coming up and Mark's like, yeah, you'll drive down our bus and he picks me up and he's like, oh, yeah, we got to change the rear main seal. It's leaking. I'm like, oh, well, when we get to Sebring, he's like, oh, maybe. I don't know if it'll last. Maybe we'll have to do it on the side of the road. So, yeah. Change the rear main seal in this combi at a truck stop on the way to Sebring for the 12 hour. And Sebring was just mad. Like that was crazy. And then, race back from Sebring to do a photo shoot of Chad's ute and get handed the keys to a 997 GT3. It's like, you're the driver. I'm like, the what? Yeah. It's like, yeah, you're driving while we hang out the windows and take the photos. And Yeah, yeah, all I can say is, yeah, 145 mile an hour in a GT3 and you stand on the brakes, it's the braking performance is probably more exciting than the straight line performance. And it's such a docile car until you turn it up. And yeah, and then wound out the trip with a VIP tour of the Brumos collection before they moved into their new facility. And yeah, I think the last part of that trip, the icing on the cake was getting the chance to be a producer on the Hurley Haywood documentary. So when you watch the doco, there's it comes up with a list of producers at the end of it. And yeah, my name's on there. So it's a bit of a legacy to pass on to my boys that I can be
fantastic.
Like, hey, Dad helped produce this film. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. We probably should think about wrapping it up. I think this has been a good show from my point of view. I hope everyone's enjoyed, and we might do this again. I guess we should also take the time to give an update on issue 3 of Sports Car Safari, which is imminent. It's going through the final stages of production as we speak, and yeah, we'll hopefully be out in the coming weeks, which will give you something to read. I know it's been a little bit of a time since the last one, but we will we'll have the new one there. There's some very cool stuff in the next issue. I think it's definitely going to be our best one, at least from where I'm standing. So
it'll be great. It'll be fantastic.
They always say the next one's the best one.
It's the hook. Get you in. But no, I genuinely think it is. I think we've got some very cool stories, and it's gonna be good.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. And thanks to everyone who's had a watch, and for all the guys coming in live. We've had a few comments and a few bits and pieces in there. It'd be really cool. I mean, Andrew and I kind of decided that we wanted to do YouTube live streaming just so that we could actually have some interaction with people. Next time we do the podcast, which we're planning to do next Thursday.
Weekly.
Just jump in the chat, ask us anything you want. We'll get to it at the end of the show, and try and involve you guys in this, because we won't be as much, because I mean there's so many people out there with like awesome questions and awesome ideas that we can't cover, or come up with. So it'd be great to have your involvement as well. The other thing that would be awesome is if we could get our subscribers on YouTube to over 100, because one thing that bugs me, not that I have OCD or anything, but the fact that we can't do a custom URL without 100 subscribers. So I know it's a bit crazy, but if we could get that, that'd be wicked. And then my OCD can be satisfied.
Cool.
Right. Yeah, so thanks, Sander, for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, mate. Thank you.
On the first podcast, it's great. It's fantastic. You made it.
That Hornet story is going to be a tough one to top that.
You guys know some amazing people. I'm sure you'll get stuff. It's great.
Hornet. Yeah. All the jealousy. I'll be able to get one soon. One thing that I love doing with the boys is going to the Aviation Museum in Adelaide. And they told me last time I was there, they got F-111.
Yep.
But they told me they're getting an F-18 soon.
I mean, I feel old.
I can go sit in there and pretend to be
service when I joined. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Cool. All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Stay safe.
We'll see you this Sunday.
Thank you. Bye.